Hey, everybody, it's the Spectacle Podcast with Scott McKay, a senior editor at the American Spectator, publisher of The Hayride, Reviver.com, and also I'm the author of Racism, Revenge, and Ruin. It's all Obama. And with me is American Spectator publisher, Melissa McKenzie. How you doing, Melissa?
I'm doing great, Scott. Thank you for asking.
Hey, what kind of show do we have today?
We have a crazy show today. No, we have a great show. We have the author of The Anti-Mary Exposed, and Carrie Greth is going to be with us today. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you.
We're so pleased to have you. You are a columnist now for the American Spectator. We can say that because you were in our most recent print magazine that we were talking about, kind of the revolution within and without religion in America and the world. So thank you for that.
Oh, my pleasure. It was great.
Well, so there has been controversies coming up. In fact, last week I did a podcast segment about, Scott and I did a podcast segment about a kind of famous YouTuber. Her name is Pearl. And she was talking about how marriage is a bad deal for men, that she wasn't sure about Mary. And basically that the Catholic Church was elevating her probably too much, because women historically have been elevated too much. And I went a little crazy about that. I was, to say the least, incensed, because I actually didn't read this book till this weekend. So like, my kids had both read the book and like, Mom, you got to read it. And it's on my stack of stuff about 20 books deep, and I hadn't read it yet. And it always makes you feel smarter when you read someone who says what you're thinking, but says it much better. And so your book is fantastic, and you talk about how feminism has completely infected womanhood and become a huge, huge problem, undermining motherhood.
Yeah.
And you go into the roots of it in the first few chapters. I have so much highlighted here that I almost don't know where to start. So you're talking about, I want to get back to where you started later, because talking specifically about Mary and how she's a problem for Satan and feminists, which could be kind of one and the same. And you talk about what feminism has done to women.
Mm-hmm.
And in your chapter, you talk about goddess worship is afoot. And I want to read something that you said and ask you to expand upon this. Okay. Divinizing women, you say, this is on page 31, promoting lesbianism, abandoning logic and reason and lying should be enough to make the connection between the goddess movement and an anti-Marian spirit clear. Unfortunately, the movement isn't limited to a small cabal of witches. One of our young writers, Ellie Gardy, wrote about the rise of witchcraft, also for the magazine.
Yeah.
And so you talk about the Jezebel spirit, the refusing facts and all of this. She's manipulative, deceitful, deceptive, seductive, and narcissistic. That could basically describe how women, young women, are actually encouraged to be now.
Yeah. No, it's pretty amazing. I mean, I got the idea for this book. The word anti-Mary didn't exist. Actually, we had my publisher and I actually had to figure out, like, do we hyphenate it? What gets capitalized? And it was a whole discussion because it didn't really exist. And, it was during the Clinton Trump election that it just kind of hit me between the eyes. Like, the elite women in our culture aren't just slightly adrift, you know, from Christian principles, but they're actually diametrically opposed to it. And that had Hillary Clinton won, she would have been the most powerful woman in the world. And, you know, I'd just been reading about the Blessed Mother, the Virgin Mother, being called the the most famous woman in the world by National Geographic. So this isn't something that was some sort of like uber Catholic site that was saying this, but because of the art, the music, all the different ways in which Mary has been honored throughout the centuries, and just as a model, both for men and women of the Christian life, she really had this role front and center. So that was kind of what drove this was, okay, what has happened to women? And so this was the really amazing thing, was to start really mapping it onto certainly the occult aspects and the Jezebel aspects that you just listed. There's also a goddess named Lilith a demon really named Lilith that came up that was super interesting. And I was really, just horrified when I realized Lilith is actually described as the demon that seduces men and kills babies. And I just thought about like what has happened to women since the 1960s. This is what we're told to do, is be living this, radical free love lifestyle, and it's taken care of through abortion, and any of the consequences are just vanish. And so anyway, it's obviously turned into it was this book first. This one came out in 2018, and then my more recent book, The End of Woman, which is a more secular book with Regnery Press, that has just come out. It's kind of a prequel because I didn't ever look at first wave feminism in this book, and that's what I went back to. And I think the real pattern that has unfolded between both books is to just really recognize that there are three aspects of feminism that are affecting all of us. And the first one is certainly this occult aspect. And there's a ton of evidence about this in the 1800s that I think we think of women in sort of more Victorian kind of way, and presume that was not the case, but there's a lot of evidence for that. So that's the occult. The second one is free love, which is this idea of getting rid of the family, getting rid of monogamy, and allowing women to sort of have the sexual license that bad men presumably have or do have, where they don't have any consequences seemingly from their promiscuous actions. And then the third one is to reorganize or restructure society. So getting away again from the family, but this is where the idea of smashing the patriarchy comes from, of really trying to really destroy the gifts that men have and replace that with what are seemingly supposed to be the strengths of women, and this kind of egalitarianism, or even the erasing of the sexes altogether. Kind of this genderless world that we live in. And you can see it in the language too, where people are just, feminism is this idea that women are persons, and, kind of just finely tuning this notion that we're not meant to be sexed.
You say in the book that women are vessels, one way or another, they're vessels. So mm-hmm. like, whether it's carrying a baby, they carry hopes and dreams for their family, mm-hmm. and their fixers. They, mm-hmm. And one of the things that's interesting biologically is the very first thing that when a sperm hits an egg, the very first thing that the egg does is start fixing the genetic code that's broken in the sperm. It's the very first thing that happens.
It's amazing. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because the DNA that is carried by the sperm has only one chain for male, one chain for female, and that mm-hmm. creates the sex. So mm-hmm. if there is any genetic code errors, the female egg has two sets of code and can go in and fix it. Mm-hmm. And so right from the beginning, women are in the position of one, taking in, because mm-hmm. that's what the egg does, is that the egg basically takes in the head of the sperm, and then it fixes it. Wow. And so like,
and not only that, actually, I just want to add, it's also providing the nourishment.
Exactly.
Apparently there are aspects of the sperm that are providing some kind of protection too. So that's mm-hmm. super interesting. I didn't realize that part about the code, but the fixing, that's amazing.
Yes. So like, so when you were describing in here, how women carry the needs, hopes, fears, anxiety, and love of others, mm-hmm. that it is, so in a way, feminism is this kind of warped sense of trying to fix the external world, but was started by all these women who had broken relationships with their own mothers and totally dysfunctional relationships and fathers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you have these broken women who are externalizing their own, and you see this to this day. If you want to go to like the Pussy Hat March or whatever, there's not one woman who looks like you're like, well, you know, these ladies, I wrote an article on one of the speakers. She literally was a murderess. She tortured, she along with two other people tied up this guy, tortured him and killed him. And they were having her as one of the speakers. And I wrote about it and they removed her from the list. But I was like, talk about.
How did she make the list in the first place? Yeah.
Well, exactly. She was one of the keynote speakers. And they evidently she was reformed after she'd spent 6 or 7 years in prison. But I was like, after torturing a man to death.
That's amazing. And, you know, that was the other astounding thing right from the very beginning. Mary Wollstonecraft is sort of considered the first foundress of feminism, even though that language wasn't used then. But she had a horrible life. I mean, it's just incredible the amount of suffering that she went through, you know, horrible parents and just this real pattern. And so you can sort of see feminism as becomes this protective garb where you no longer have to be vulnerable. You know, it's really an effort to sort of erase risk, but it also erases vulnerability. And what's required not only for spouses, you know, is this kind of vulnerability, but also when you're bearing children, you make yourself incredibly vulnerable by the process of birth and delivery or gestation and birth. So it's really interesting to just see how these aspects that we see make women vulnerable are exactly what are being pushed out. And it's kind of this desire and this idealization of us as an island or, you know, independence. I think that's the kind of the starting point I found back in the early 1810s. Percy Shelley, the poet, is actually the first one to really articulate this idea of the independent woman. And that's really the idea that just took off. And we can see it so much in the culture today.
Well, the other thing is that, like, one of the points that I've made as about abortion is abortion still is within the woman. So, like, she still is vulnerable and she still has to live with the consequences of it. And this is something that none of the feminists really want to talk about. And even birth control. Mm-hmm. So, say a woman is on the pill, it's still within her. It's still changing her biology, her biochemistry, making her changes her choices in men that she pairs with, changes everything. And then, so she gets STDs within her. It's unseen. All of these ways that as a woman, she's still vulnerable. It's a lie to say that she's not.
Right. No, that's such a great point. That's really, really important because the ramifications are so deep. I mean, especially when you look at the connection between abortion and birth control and, you know, all of that. So yeah, that's a really profound insight.
Well, okay, so you say in the new matriarchy, this which is another chapter in this book, and we can talk about your new book too, as far as like the feminist founders. So, you know, just feel free to shoot when we're talking about this, but that women are always victims, men and masculinity must change, others must provide women unrestricted access to contraception and abortion. Women will only be equal when they are considered exactly the same as men. Society must accept gender neutrality. Men have nothing to say about abortion. And the newest one, let's share baby parts, grab your big hat or your vagina dress. So there's the, can you explain to everybody why you think Mary is the answer to this kind of, and frankly, dystopian ideology held up by these insane tenets?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's the big and fundamental question. And this is, I think partially because what we've seen is really this rejection of Mary as a model of womanhood. And I think that's, you know, it's hard to explain this in very sort of small sound bites because a lot of us just see Mary as sort of a saccharine statue and feel kind of this removal. But if you look at certainly her as the mother of God and her fiat, her saying yes to God and being, will you be the mother of God? There's this openness and this humility and this receptivity and this vulnerability, like we were just talking about, which Mary certainly embodies. But there's also this sense of really knowing the right order of civilization, of knowing the way in which God works and putting her will under his and all of that. You know, and even just to say this out loud, it feels very It's very hard to kind of wrap our minds around because we've become so anti-Christian or so non-Christian in our culture. But I think that the beautiful thing is that she has this capacity to be a model for us in the things that she desires and the things that she is. And this was really the second half of the book. And I think this is one of the things that it's hard to do, and I probably don't do enough of it, is really try to help women wrap their minds around what it actually means to be women. Because we've been told our whole lives, I know I've been told my whole life, that you need to compete with men and be like men and be ambitious and, you know, all of these messages that are given to us day in and day out from the culture. But she's, her message is, you know, her she's really the embodiment of, you know, trying to do God's will. This is what she did better than anyone who lived on the planet other than Christ himself. She also has this desire to be beautiful, which I think she is beautiful. I don't think she has the desire for it, but she is beautiful. And this was one of the things I wrote this book called The Marian Option. And it was amazing that every single apparition that has ever been had of the Virgin Mother, everybody to one said she was so beautiful. Saint Bernadette had a vision of her when she was a child and said she was so beautiful you would want to die just to see, so you could see her again. So I think that was a really interesting thing to discover, was that she's this thing that all women want to be. You know, look at how much money we spend on clothing and on makeup and on, you know, Botox and weight loss and all these kinds of things. So this isn't just a disorder. This isn't something that's just vanity. This is something that God has instilled in a woman on purpose. So, and then the third thing is, you know, woman really wants to do something good. And, you know, it was funny, after I wrote this book, I just stumbled upon the Hallmark Channel. Somebody had told me about it. And so I'd never watched the Hallmark Channel before, but I realized this is why the Hallmark Channel is so popular, because it kind of taps into all these desires that women have. Is, you know, here's this woman that she's leaving her corporate job to go back to her hometown to rescue the library. And she falls in love and meets the man, you know, all of these things happen. And this is really the recipe that I think is, you know, I mean, it's trite and tedious, and it's obviously lived out in so many manifold ways with different women. This is why it's been so successful, is because they've sort of tapped into this capacity of, or this desires that women have. Now, obviously all of this has to be done in an ordered way. And that's, you know, really the beauty of the Christian message, is to show us how to do that instead of getting caught up in the power grab that I think feminism has become. I mean, feminism really is about power and control. And what's the Virgin Mother? You know, she's all about humility and surrender. So I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, it's just, if we're going to go anywhere, we've got this 2000 year plus model. You know, we don't really need to reinvent the wheel, but we have to help people understand how to discern it, instead of it, again, feeling like this is obscure or saccharine or, you know, totally inapplicable and inapplicable to our lives and on a daily basis.
Okay. One of the interesting things, so I'm just to give a little bit of background, the readers and stuff know this, but I've only been Catholic for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And part of what brought me to the church was Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was because I saw Mary in particular being attacked.
Mm.
And I was like, Satan only attacks where goodness and the Holy Spirit really is.
Yeah.
So like all of these statues and churches being desecrated, you mentioned some of this historically, right? That's where God is. Like, you know, God doesn't, or Satan doesn't have to attack where God isn't. He's already got it. So he doesn't have to do anything. But, you know, Mary keeps getting attacked over and over again.
Mm-hmm. And I would add to that. I think this is why women are being so under attack and have been so under attack, because we are a model, are meant to be sort of small icons of who Our Lady is, because she's so instrumental in the Christian life that if you actually can erase what womanhood is and motherhood is, the good aspects of it, then it's very hard for people to imagine the motherhood that Our Lady embodies and her capacity to really bring, you know, to really care for and lead her children to their final home.
Mm.
So sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that I'm just thinking about what you said. I'm wondering, too, Scott's not saying anything here because he's a dude, but
I'm just soaking this in. This is great stuff.
It is great stuff, but I'm just thinking about from a guy's perspective, because he's a single guy and he's out there in the dating world and exactly.
Thank you, Carrie. I appreciate that.
You have my sympathies. I'll be praying for you.
You know, so like you talk about what the female heart aches for, some specific things to know the truth of who we are and a secure recognition of our dignity. And Kate, who was our producer, was talking about how dangerous it felt in this world to be a woman who might want to be a mother, because not only does she know rightly that her children will be attacked and that she will be attacked, a woman who decides to become a mother. But the men who are having to deal with these fearful women also is dealing with the consequences. And I was wondering, Scott, what you thought about that. You know, like, you're not coming across very many virginal Mary types, I'm guessing.
Well, the culture expressly selects those out. And of course, we've had this this ongoing conversation here at the Spectacle about the, you know, the four numbers that govern American society. Carrie, I'm going to hit you with these. So in the 2022 midterm elections, right, four groups of people, married men, married women, single men, single women. Married men are R plus 20. Married women were R plus 14. Single men were R plus 7. And unmarried women were D plus 37. So my theory is you have a bunch of expressly political Obama Democrats who are in charge of pretty much all of the cultural institutions in the country. They know these numbers. And so, you know, once you see this stuff, you can't unsee it. And the answer is they're trying to make as many single women who will vote Democrat religiously as they possibly can. And they're using every single cultural and political and even economic lever that they can to create and maintain that population. Now, the societal consequences of this are catastrophic because what you're getting is, and of course, there's a 13-point delta between unmarried men and married men, right? So they want to keep the men from getting married, but most of the men are going to vote Republican, period. But when you have a plus 14 on one side and a minus 37 on the other, this is the game is, not only do we want to keep women from wanting to get married to men, we need to make women unmarriageable, right? So you go have a high body count when you're in your early 20s, right? Which will make you unattractive to men for the rest of your life. Cultivate a mentality that is expressly hostile to males. And all of these other things, right? Like we've taken sort of the, you know, the archetype of like the Disney princess who was like gonna marry the prince, and now she don't need no man, right? Like, I mean, that whole, that's been a massive sea change. And it's interesting that at the box office, these women who beat up the guys who are twice their size, right? Nobody wants to watch any of this. Like, these movies are dogs with fleas every time they're released, pretty much. And yet they continue pushing. So, like, my question to you is, like, how much of, you know, the aggressive feminism that we see in our culture, like, how much of this do you think is driven by politics, or how much of it do you think is driven by sort of some cultural, you know, impetus that comes from, you know, whatever, the academia or any of that? I think it's Democrats trying to make Democrats.
I love this question. And I, you know, this is one of the things that I have, I mean, one of the reasons why I have written these books, because the women's vote just drives me nuts. It's incredible over and over and over again. And it feels like we don't do anything about it. We talk about it, we acknowledge the numbers, and then we just sort of throw up our hands and just feel like there's nowhere to move. And so this is, you know, basically what you just said is sort of what I've been saying for years, is all of the cultural elements have been locked up by the feminists for a long time. much more, I think much more than since before 2012, but that 2012 was probably the confirmation of it, where they just found this is so fruitful and we're so successful. And we, you know, this is just the way to keep moving forward and, you know, really pushing this. So yeah, I think it's incredible. Especially when you look at just the messaging with abortion has changed so much. It used to be, you know, during Bill Clinton, it was, you know, safe, legal, and rare. Now it's shout your abortion. And so they just ratchet it up to make it sound like these things are really attractive and really compelling. And, you know, this promise of freedom and independence, like I was mentioning earlier, that's what's going to come about if you live this kind of savvy lifestyle that the left is presenting. And, you know, of course, you can also see how effective they've been, not just to articulate who the savvy woman is, but also the doormat woman, you know, the opposite, the anti-feminist, or, you know, she's unintelligent, grumpy, you know, just this passive doormat of a human being. So I think that this is, you know, really where, why I've created a whole series of books called Theology of Home, just trying to like give women a sense of what it looks like to actually be a real woman in the culture again, and that it's beautiful and it can be compelling, because all that we see is its opposite. So yeah, it would be amazing. I mean, like, think about the checkout stand. There's not a single conservative women's magazine. There's the only thing that's close is Joanna Gaines's magazine. And that's, you know, there's some issues and certainly things creeping in there, but there's nothing overtly there. And this is, we just don't spend money on these kinds of things. But imagine if we actually spent money on trying to promote the beauty of womanhood and what it really looks like, because what it really looks like is actually what has the capacity to fulfill women. What they're offering will never fulfill women, will always make them angry and bitter and frustrated. And that's what we see all the time in the culture when you're really talking to women versus what's just sort of presented as, you know, in fashion magazines and whatnot. So yeah, I think it's a huge problem. I haven't really looked into how much is actually driven. Well, I think it's all driven by the elites. I think men and women. I would love to get back eventually and actually look in things like Soviet archives. I think there's so much of it that happened then. You know, there's all this discussion about who funded Ms. Magazine and Gloria Steinem and, you know, all of that. I think there's a lot of data out there that I haven't really dug into sufficiently. But the other thing is that, you know, and you hit on this to a degree, is that these elements, especially abortion, not only breaks women, but it makes them, unless you go through sort of a healing process, it makes you a voice and an advocate and a pusher of abortion, because you're sort of in this position where you either have to promote it or heal from it. It's very hard to be in the middle of it. And so that's the other piece, is you just continue to break women who then will keep promoting this cause. And, you know, this is who you see at these women's marches. So in any event, it's really fascinating to start looking at this data and start thinking about outside the box. How do we start helping women instead of, you know, just giving in to the left over and over again?
Well, the thing is with abortion, that women who, once they've had an abortion, it's kind of like they don't know what it means to be a mother until they're a mother. Like we have, certain, you have to step out on faith. Like you don't know what marriage is like until you're married. You don't know what what it's like to carry a child until you've carried one, and then to abort one, you don't know until you know, and then you're forced. My experience was, because before I came to this, I was a doctor, and so I had patients, and the women who had abortions were, to a person, just either coerced. Well, all of them except for one were coerced, every single woman, and had deep, profound shame. So now you have women who, and it's in their body, like it's because they realize, you know, this discussion, well, it's not, it's like a parasite. No. It's a miracle. It's its own life, and it is you. And, you know, that is one of the things, because it changes profoundly the woman who carries the baby. She's not the same biological entity once she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. And any woman who's pregnant, like my daughter in particular, I remember I'd never had a day of heartburn in my life. That I think the sperm hit the egg. The pregnancy didn't even test come positive, and I suddenly had heartburn. I was like, oh, mm-hmm. and And the tests were negative. And I was like, I knew I was pregnant, you know, like I just knew because I was like, this is insane.
Yeah.
And so, you know, once a woman has it, and the, you know, this might've been a 4-cell, you know, zygote at that point. And I was physically changed immediately. And so like, there's no going back from that. You are in that moment, a mother. And so the women who've had repeated, you know, lost the baby with, you know, stillbirth or miscarriage or something like that is a mother too. And she knows it deep in her bones. And then suddenly she's not a mother when she aborts the baby, you know.
Right.
You say, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, you know, I think this is one of the things that we have to get back to is this understanding of motherhood and not just a biological sense either. I think there's spiritual motherhood and there's like psychological or kind of mentoring motherhood, these things that, you know, aunts do and teachers and people like that in our lives. And we can't discount that. And so I think this is one of the pieces that makes it such a strange thing that when we really become a biological mother, like I haven't been preparing for this ever. I never thought about this, right? You know, how this would change my life because we haven't thought of ourselves in that mode. Whereas, you know, this is the way little girls are raised from the very beginning, you know, playing with dolls and being engaged as, you know, thinking of themselves as one day becoming mothers or being in that kind of maternal role. So I think that's a really important piece of kind of moving into the future is not being afraid of this concept of motherhood in a really broad sense and looking at it that way too, instead of just, you know, the biological or adoptive kind of bearing children aspect of it.
Well, it's funny because I was at a, you know, work conference in Florida and someone asked me, you know, about, you know, what it was like running the organization, that sort of thing. And I said, I don't view it any differently than I do motherhood. I'm as happy as the least happy child. And I'm as happy as my least happy employee. And so when somebody is having a difficult time, or if it's tough, or my writers are having a tough time, it's not like it's a different skill set that I'm bringing. It's the same organizational thing. It's the same. And it's different for men. Men are a completely a different creature when it comes to how they manage and the strengths they bring to both the workplace and the home. Yeah. And
that's a great point.
It just needs to be acknowledged. You really acknowledge it in this book. You say, without women's good influence, society cannot renew her itself. And you further say, every woman is called to be a bridge between her family and heaven. Can you explain that? I really feel like positively explaining these things and telling our young women, there's certain things, like I tell the young women who work for me, you get smarter when you're a mother. You get braver when you're a mother. You're stronger physically and mentally and emotionally and more creative. It's like something opens up in you. None of this is really talked about effectively in my view. It's always the limitations of what it is to become a mother.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. And I've thought about it a lot. I have 5 children and I thought, I finished my doctoral dissertation shortly after the third child was born. And just my capacity to persevere through having children and finishing a dissertation, I don't think I would have finished it probably if I wasn't a mother, because the arduousness of motherhood really was like actually made writing a doctorate look pretty easy because I didn't have to do it in the middle of the night, you know, all those demands. So yeah, I think there's just incredible gifts that come from motherhood that you would not ever exercise. You would never exercise those virtues otherwise. As far as that connection between our family and heaven, you know, one of the things that the images that I think I mentioned in this book is that great statue in St. Matthew's Cathedral in downtown Washington, D.C. And you can look for it. People can find it online very easily. But it's this fabulous image of Our Lady. And she's sort of bending down with one hand out to whomever is looking at her. And then the other hand is up pointing to heaven. And I just always was drawn to that, even as a single woman, because I think that women have that capacity through their beauty and their goodness to really reveal a comfort and a, you know, they allow us to see ourselves differently. we're kind of a mirror of ourselves, but we see ourselves in a good light through the eyes of the mother. I mean, this is what's supposed to happen. We're supposed to see kind of our best self through that. And I think this is what Our Lady provides us, because she sort of gives us hope that we're not stuck in our ugliness. We're made to be good, and we were made to, and you know, be part of the family in heaven in the afterlife. And she kind of mediates that for us. Also, obviously, being human, that's the other aspect of it. But yeah, and you know, on a more practical level, of course, I go into this deeply in my books, Theology of Home, that I've written with my colleague Noelle Mehring, where we really talk about the home as a foretaste of heaven, that this is meant to be kind of a, you know, a teaser of what heaven will be like. So that those are all, I think, different ways to see it.
Well, and any woman, even before she's married or has children, has a sense, like you walk into a guy's apartment and it is the rare guy who,
yeah,
it's a utilitarian.
His need is a pin and right.
Right. Exercise.
Throw pillows. Right. Yeah.
I mean, it just really is. But I had a girlfriend say to me, she goes, Melissa, you know, when your kid goes to college, don't even try to, you know, take him shopping or whatever, just get the basic stuff he needs. And she's like, I made the mistake with my oldest of trying to help him decorate his room. You know, save that for your daughter. And right. It was great advice, but there's just this innateness. And then you go into like my son's girlfriend's dorm and her room is resplendent. And it is an indication of the home that she will one day create. It is
right.
It is beautiful. It is lovely. She cares about the details. And that is the, you know, meanwhile, you know, the guys that are out there conquering stuff and doing what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
But we don't have any elevation of these obvious innate gender differences, sex differences, and celebrating them.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, this is still in a way, it's a man's world, even though it's feminized. It's like a feminized overlay. And the feminists are like trying to say that a true woman is independent, like a terrible man.
Yeah. No, that's the model that they have created for us, for sure.
Okay. Absolutely. So you've mentioned a couple of your different books today. And if you could go through them for everybody, because I actually have the Theology of Home. I've got your Anti-Mary Exposed book.
Yep.
What your other books?
The End of Woman just came out in August. And that's kind of a secular book. It's actually like this book a lot, but much more for a secular Protestant audience. We have three Theology of Home books. And then I've done some earlier ones too, but those are really the main ones that I think would be helpful on this topic.
Do you have a place where you consistently write where people can find your work?
Yeah, Theology of Home website.
Okay.
I have a blog there and my writing always appears there as well.
Theology of Home. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Carrie. There's so much more I feel like you can say. And of course, I hope you'll write again for us at the American Spectator.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Thank you much.
So pleased to have you. And everybody, you can like and subscribe the American Spectator, the spectacle here. Subscribe to the American Spectator, our latest print edition, which Carrie is in. You can see the cover here. There's hopefully a revival. The fifth wave, we'll see if that's actually happening. Anyway, you can subscribe to that, the print magazine, and go find Carrie and her work at Theology of Home. So thank you so much again for joining us, and thank you all for watching.